As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Wednesday, October 5th, 2016. I would now like to turn the conference over to Larry Levitt. Please go ahead.
Thank you. This is Larry Levitt from the Kaiser Family Foundation. Welcome to this web conversation about how to address growing prescription drug costs. Prescription drugs are the fastest growing part of the U.S. healthcare system. Retail drug spending spiked 11% in 2014, at the same time that growth in overall health spending remained relatively modest. All indications are that drug spending growth has decelerated more recently, but it's still been increasing faster than care provided by doctors and hospitals. Recent developments have put drug pricing in the news, including dramatic increases in the price of EpiPen that have drawn the attention of policymakers in the last several weeks. Increases in drug costs have also resonated as a public concern. Ensuring that high-cost drugs are affordable to those who need them has emerged as the public's top healthcare priority. A substantial majority believe that drug prices are unreasonable, and they support a variety of proposals aimed at keeping drug costs down, including greater price transparency, federal negotiation of drug prices in Medicare, importation of lower-priced drugs from Canada, curbs on prices for high-cost drugs, and independent review of drug price increases. These ideas have all emerged in the election, including in the presidential campaign. To discuss these issues, we're joined by a terrific panel of experts. Jerry Anderson is a professor in Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dana Goldman is the Leonard Schaefer Chair and Director of the UST Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics. And Jenny Bryan is the Senior Vice President for Policy and Research at the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. Just remember, the full discussion is being recorded and will be available at kss.org/healthcosts. And during the live discussion, submit written questions in the chat window, and we'll get to as many of them as we can. To get started, Jerry, let me start with you. There are a bunch of proposals out there to address drug costs, which we'll certainly get to. But before we do that, how would you diagnose the problem we're trying to solve? What is it we're aiming to fix?
Well, essentially, it is that the high cost of drugs and the fact that many of us don't have access to drugs because of the high cost. So I really focus not as much on the cost as on the problems we're having with access. In the Washington Post today, for example, there's a study about Gleevec that was published in a clinical journal that says a lot of people aren't getting access to Gleevec. We know that only about 10% of the people with hepatitis C are in fact getting access to the drugs because of the high cost. So for me, the problem is access, not as much as cost.
And Dana, same question to you. What is it we're aiming to solve here?
Well, I think Jerry has it exactly right, which is that it's a problem of access. But I think we have to distinguish between short-term access and long-run access. And what I mean by that is, if someone develops an innovative therapy, then we want people to get access to it, and the best thing would be to give it away at marginal cost, and for most drugs, that's a very low price. So for Hep C, for example, we'd like that it would only be a few hundred dollars, for example. But there's also a question of long-run access, and there we recognize that we want to have access to therapies that haven't been developed yet. I mean, if you think back to the early 1990s, before the introduction of highly active antiretroviral therapy, I live in L.A., and Magic Johnson was diagnosed with HIV, and I remember his press conference, and I thought, you know, here's one of the richest athletes in the world, and he can't buy better health. But, of course, he was able to do that, and he's doing quite well now, and that was because of the introduction of therapy. So it's not just a question of access to therapies that exist today. It's a question of how we get access to new innovation. And that's a harder problem, and we know that we have a system where we give people temporary monopolies through patents and market exclusivity and the like, to ensure that they'll continue to innovate.
And do you think we're seeing problems with this long run? I mean, I think as Jerry said, there's certainly evidence of some problems of short run access. Are we seeing problems of this long run access now, or is that kind of something you more worry about as a
Well, I do worry about it because I see the threat of Alzheimer's to the continued progress of the way the elderly have improved welfare. I see the threat of obesity and also the surge in diabetes that's correlated with that. And I think, you know, we have to find solutions. And, you know, in the case of diabetes, imagine how valuable it would be if we had a cure for diabetes. Now, the playing field, I think, is tilted away from finding cures. I mean, manufacturers love treatments because they have patients who are on these drugs forever. And so we have to figure out how do we encourage that type of innovation. I think the problem is that right now the way we price, we don't reward the really innovative stuff, and we don't penalize enough the stuff that has marginal benefit. And that's a pricing issue.
Sure, sure. Now, Jenny, I'm sure it will come as no surprise to you that pharma has been under fire recently. And, you know, in our polls, the public points to excessive profit as a cause of high prices. I mean, does pharma think there is a problem here that needs solving?
Well, I think that, as the conversation has shown already, that access is an issue that we have to worry about. So, I think there are a lot of reasons that we're talking about access now, not actually just for drugs, but especially for medicines. And part of it is that deductibles have risen 10 times faster than inflation in the last 5 years, and that's a lot faster than paychecks have gone up. And so as a result, patients do sometimes find that they're having to cover costs that are challenging for them. So I think we need to look hard at making sure that benefit designs don't put a disproportionate burden on patients who suffer from chronic conditions and can't manage those costs. But I think in answer to your question, it's easy for patients to sort of assume that this is just all about profits. And I think there's a big misconception about what's actually driving healthcare costs more generally, and that and those misconceptions, I think, really play into potentially very problematic policy choices that will have long-run consequences that Dana was talking about in terms of reducing the incentive to bring the next generation of medicines forward.
So, I mean, you talked about benefit design, and we'll certainly get to that. You know, that points to insurers, employers. Is there anything on the price side that you think is reasonable to address now, particularly given the big price increases recently in certain drugs, especially generics?
Well, so I think we've been clear that we do think that there's more that can be done to incentivize competition, especially for older generic and off-patent medicines, and that it's, you know, in some ways, now that we have a market that where 90% of prescriptions are generic, it's a fair question to ask whether we've invested sufficiently in policies that will make sure that we have a robust competitive market there. And clearly there have been a lot of challenges that have been in the news over the last year or so involving those types of medicines. And I think there are a range of things that could be done to create incentives for generic entry, and it would lower the barriers there to competition, and that those are the kinds of things that we should be looking at for sure. I also go back to one thing that Dana said, which I think is he characterized patents as a temporary monopoly, and that is shorthand to be true, but I think it overstates the situation in a way that is misleading, in the sense that what a patent does is it provides some measure of assurance to an innovator that there will be a prospect that they can achieve some reward for their innovation before it can be immediately copied. But the reality is that it doesn't insulate a brand manufacturer from competition from other competitors who might come to market with a different molecule that's going after the same disease. And I think you don't have to look any farther than hepatitis C to see that a patent is not necessarily a monopoly. And so there were several really important new breakthrough medicines for hepatitis C in the years just before the launch of Sovaldi and Harvoni, the Gilead drugs that have been in the news for the last several years. But in fact, those medicines, while they were important breakthroughs, and represented real clinical advances, you'll never hear them talked about in the news. And why is that? It's because another brand medicine came along and ate their lunch really quickly. And so there is a lot of brand competition that people tend to ignore. I think that's really important distinction when you're thinking about the differences between brand medicines and generic medicines, where we worry that there wasn't a sufficiently large and attractive market for another competitor to come in and bring a product to market to compete with Daraprim, for example, the taurine drug for toxoplasmosis that was in the news last year. Or anyway, I'll stop there.
Thanks. So Dana, you were talking earlier about sort of the long run incentives for or rewards for innovation, but what about generics, which Jenny brought up? I mean, those are the vast majority of the drugs being prescribed now. They are the source of some of the big recent high profile price increases. How should we be dealing with that?
Yeah, no, thank you for asking, because you're right that about 90% of all prescriptions are generic, and they're only about 30% of the cost. And this is an important part of the market. And you mentioned that sometimes drug pricing, drug spending has not grown as quickly as other segments of healthcare. And that's because of the availability of generics. The irony is that sometimes in this market, the prices drop so low that competitors will drop out, and then suddenly you're left with, for example, one manufacturer of an EpiPen or a similar product, and that provides them the ability to now raise prices. So in some sense, the price drops so low and demand expands, and the result is we see what we see. I mean, I think it's kind of ironic to me, because I live in California, and like most states, California says, you know, electricity is an important part of people's lives, and so we're going to have a regulator who is going to ensure that there's safe and reliable supply of electricity, and that the people who are supplying it make a fair rate of return. And it seems to me generics are exactly like that. We want to make sure there's a safe and reliable supply of generics, but we also want to make sure we're not in a situation where prices drop so low no one wants to make it, and suddenly we create these anomalous decisions. And so you mentioned, you know, prices are going up. Sometimes prices go up because there's a lack of competition, and we tend to think of that as a bad thing in the generic market. And sometimes prices go up because the drugs become more valuable, and I would argue that's actually a good thing. But that's why I think it makes sense to have some sort of regulatory authority, maybe the FDA, looking at the generic market. Because in the generic market, we're not dealing with this issue of innovation. And in fact, the success of pharmaceuticals has always been that we reward the innovation for a period. Just like HIV drugs were expensive for a while, but now they're quite inexpensive.
So this is Jerry.
Hey, Jerry. Yeah.
So what you got to recognize with generics is about 17% of them do not have any competitors. So those are the Daraprims. Those are the ones that we hear about that have the very large price increases. So for many generics which have 3-4 competitors, there is not a problem. But when there are no competitors, either because for a variety of reasons, then you have these elaborate price hikes. So the question is, how do we stop those? How do we deter that from happening where there's no competitors? And there's a couple of things. One, we put some more details in a JAMA article that we wrote in January, and some testimony I did at the Aging Committee in November. But essentially, when there is no competitor, the FDA should be able to do an expedited review to get a competitor out there very quickly. There should be some compounding until that competitor exists. And there should be some importation when there is no competitor out there. Not general importation, but only when there is no competitor until there is. And the real more fundamental thing is ensuring that there is competition in the generic space. And what we've seen over the past 10 years is a lot of consolidation in the generic market, and that's something that the FTC and Department of Justice really, I think, needs to take a careful look at.
So Jerry, you mentioned importation, and that's one of the few issues where Secretary Clinton and Donald Trump agree and have called for more generalized importation of drugs, particularly from Canada. You said you did not think there should be generalized authority for importation. Why is that?
Well, I think there's about 10 to 15 countries that I think have reasonably similar standards to the FDA. But when I go to Canada or whatever, what I'm concerned about are reputable suppliers. And I don't know as a consumer that I would know that this place from Toronto or this place from London is in fact a reputable supplier. The second thing that I sort of notice in Europe is that the middlemen get most of the money in this. So if you look at Greece, typically has the lowest price, and London and Germany have the highest price. And you can import from one to another country very easily in Europe, but it turns out that the Greek price doesn't actually translate to the English price. They don't get it. So I think it's really, at least initially, should be importation in very narrow circumstances, like there is no competition in the generic market. If it works out well, we might want to expand, but I think there's enough uncertainty in the importation issue to not try to do it all at once.
Dana, let me come back to you. You may have thoughts on importation, but I also wanted to follow up on your idea of some kind of utility-like regulation in some cases for drugs, and this is something that Secretary Clinton has proposed, an independent review of price increases for life-saving drugs that have been on the market for a long time. You seem to be saying that you thought the role of that regulator should be to ensure that the price is high enough. My guess is I think Secretary Clinton was looking to make sure the price is low enough.
Yeah, well, I think, if you look at and first of all, I was talking about the generic market, and I agree with everything Jerry says. But in the generic market, when the GAO looked at this, they found that they looked at the price increases of generics over a period of 5 years. And for most of the market, for about 3,000 drugs, everything seemed to be working fine. The problem, as they saw it, was about 300 drugs where prices were doubling. And so, now a lot of those actually are quite cheap, and when they go from $1 to $2, that's a 100% increase in price, but we really don't need to worry about it. So what I was saying, and I agree with Secretary Clinton, in the generic market, we want to regulate and look at these price increases, and I think Jerry is put out quite carefully the kinds of tools we could use if we see a price increase to ensure that there's adequate supply. I think the problem where I disagree with Secretary Clinton is because I think the idea here is that we want to, on the drugs that are brand drugs, we've made a deal with these companies that they would get protection, patent and market exclusivity and some others, in return for the innovation. And if the response, I'm concerned about future generations, not the current voters. Again, I want to think about the people with Alzheimer's and make sure there's a stream of innovation that's going to help them. And for those people, actually, they want high prices today because they know that'll encourage innovation. I mean, malaria kills 500,000 people a year globally. I mean, you talk about an unmet need, and yet it took a philanthropist, Bill Gates, coming in and spending his own money to develop drugs. And that's because in the markets where we would sell anti-malarials, the prices are very low. So I think we as Americans, whatever policy solution we develop, we have to understand that while there's an urge to ensure access today, there's also we want to ensure that there's sufficient stream of innovation, and I'm not sure in a politicized environment it's easy to do that.
Jerry, let me come back to you. You know, we've had several questions from the audience about prices and whether prices are, how big a factor prices are in current access, which you raised initially. I mean, how big a factor do you think price is in the access problems now? And you know, so what should we be doing about price more generally?
So I think they are, in many cases, not a problem at all, but I think we have a whole series of recent evidence where there is a serious problem, and I think, you know, hepatitis C is one of those great examples of this. This is a disease that is the number one killer for infectious diseases in the United States, hepatitis C. It is one that where there is a drug that is probably successful in most of the cases in treating somebody. So it's something that you want to have. From an infectious disease perspective, it's something you definitely want to have because you want to spread, you want to stop the spread of an infectious disease. So it has a huge public health implication. And yet, we don't know exactly how many people are getting it, but we think that it's a very small percentage, something like 10% of the population. But if we had an infectious disease, you know, like mumps or something like that, we would want to get everybody to have it. It's very expensive for a Medicaid program. It's very expensive for the prisons. It's very expensive for Medicare beneficiaries who probably end up paying somewhere around $6,000 to $8,000 for that drug. And if you're on Social Security and you're making $20,000, because that's all the income you have, which is a lot of Social Security recipients, $6,000 is a huge amount of money, probably not affordable. So we've got to figure out a way to get those prices down because access is a huge problem for a number of drugs.
So could I add to that?
Sure.
Yeah, so I agree with Jerry. So the question is, how do you get the price down? But understanding that you want people to be developing these, and the solution in Hep C, I think, is to understand if we treat everyone today for Hep C, we have the opportunity to eliminate Hep C, not only in the United States, but globally, just like we eradicated polio. And so that benefit plays out to future generations. We on the call and the people listening in, don't worry about polio. That is a benefit to us from innovation that was developed years ago. So the answer with Hep C is that if we had tied reimbursement to rates of infection or rates of liver transplants, and we'd spread out the payments so that the people who benefit, which is people going forward for years and years, were bearing some of the costs, then we could have both rewarded the innovation and ensured access. And I think that's the secret here. You know, the answer isn't to say, oh, you've developed a new drug. It's so good, we want it free. I don't think that's fine. It works for that drug, but it discourages the innovation. The answer is to say, you've developed a new drug. We want to ensure access. How can we spread out the payments and that you're in a performance-based contract so that if your drug actually delivers on the promise and helps us eradicate the disease, then you'll make a lot of money, but we spread it out over all the beneficiaries.
So Dana, how do you put those, I mean, how do you make those kind of performance-based contracts work? I mean, what are the policy levers?
Well, so for example, the insurers in a state, which includes the correctional facility and the Medicaid programs and people who are, I agree with Jerry, they're cash-strapped, as well as the private payers could get together and say, in this state, we're going to provide access to this drug, but we're going to spread out the payments and we're going to tie them to rates of infection in the state. And so you have very clear metrics for how you can do that. Now, it's challenging, but in this case, actually, it's pretty simple to test, find out whether people are infected with HCV, so you could do that. And you could also tie it to the rates of liver transplants in the Medicare program. So I think it's just sitting people down. Now, one of the ways we tie the hands of all parties here is we have these rules in Medicaid that they get the best price. And what that does is Medicaid could argue, well, the price is free because, you know, the payments are in the future. And that creates a regulatory and legal challenge that prevents these types of contracts.
Another approach is to basically give the drug companies the exact same amount of money they would have gotten for insuring 10% of the people, but in fact insuring all of the people. So if the drug companies are going to get $10 billion for a particular drug for taking care of 10% of the people by charging a lot, they could also get the same $10 billion but cover everybody by taking a lower price, but essentially having a whole series of programs in place to guarantee a lot more compliance, a lot more agreement,
yeah.
Something that they can't do now because they can't really do the compliance programs. But if they could partner with the prisons or they could partner with the Medicaid programs and getting everybody with hepatitis C enrolled and taking the drug, they would get the same amount of money. So that would still allow you to have new innovation, but it would get 100% compliance.
Yeah, and actually I want to point out that's what we on that point, though, that's what we do with vaccines. So we say vaccines are reasonably cheap, but we say we mandate everyone has to have it. So we've expanded the market through essentially government fiat. And so the revenues commensurately increase. And so there is a notion that we could do that. The other thing in HCV is you could just buy out the innovation if it's so valuable. Sorry.
So this raises a question. Jenny, go ahead.
I think one thing I just point out here is that for sure it's right that in the case of hepatitis C, the way to think about it is it's about an upfront cash problem, not about a value issue, because we could wipe out hepatitis C, and there's not much question that an investment today in the medicines would, in fact, pay off over the longer run in lower health care costs for that population, whether you're talking about Medicaid or the prisons. The problem is that a Medicaid budget is year to year, and they're not in a position to make that investment that way. So you do need more innovative payment arrangements potentially to make that possible, or you just need to make a public investment. But the point I make more generally is that the entire healthcare system is moving away from sort of a fee-for-service, transaction-by-transaction approach to payment toward payments that are based on performance and based on value. And there are, and Dana alluded to this, there are sort of regulatory hurdles for manufacturers in being part of that shift. And the entire regulatory infrastructure around drug pricing is based on an assumption that the payment will always be unit by unit. And the reality is that medicines are critical part of care. And as payers want to set up bundles and as they want to move toward more innovative arrangements with providers, how the medicine should be a piece of that, but the ability to sort of develop those innovative contracting relationships has been slowed down, I guess, in today's world. And so if we want to think about things that could improve the market and could lead to prices that people would feel are more commensurate with value, one way to do that is to think about changes to those regulations.
Yeah, and an example of that, I think that's an important point. The FDA, for example, can be part of the solution, not the problem, and I think they want to be. The FDA is run pretty well, but, you know, if your label says, let's say you have a new drug for heart failure and your label says that you reduce mortality, but it doesn't say you reduce hospitalizations. But a payer they're the insurance company who's providing the drug really cares about reduced hospitalizations because that's a place where there's some savings in heart failure. those two parties, the manufacturer and the insurance company, can't contract on reduced hospitalizations because it's not in the label. But that's a social outcome we all care about. In fact, Medicare is rewarding hospitals for lower rates of readmission for heart failure. So we have to get the, I think the regulatory bodies, it's a relatively simple fix to say, you know, we should allow flexibility in the reimbursement so that even if something's outside the label, but it's something people care about, we could agree on it. I mean, and another example is, you know, the FDA is producing, is getting breakthrough therapies on the market using biomarkers. So, in other words, let's say you wanted to test a drug for earlier stage prostate cancer. You know, what we care about is that people live longer. But sometimes that takes 10 or 15 years. And so the FDA will look at a biomarker, maybe it's tumor progression or something, or some of these innovative blood tests, and they might approve it. And so then think of a dilemma for an insurance company. We don't know if this is going to work and it's going to cost a fair bit of money. The right answer is to contract on future outcomes. And in the current environment, it's very difficult to do that.
So I agree with Jenny on the whole issue of bundled payments. I mean, if you look at it, Medicare and value-based purchasing have gradually expanded the bundled payments. I first worked in HHS and helped design the DRG system, which was our first example of bundled payments. We've done a whole series of things in bundling for hospitals and physicians and post-acute care and even now hospice. But the one thing that's not in any of the bundled payments so far is Part D drugs. And those need to be in there because when a doctor sits and says, what do I need to do, or a care manager says, what do I need to have as part of the things to treat me, drugs are clearly a very important component of that, yet they remain fee-for-service payment, typically carved out, typically outside of the realm of what the doctor has. So there are some technical challenges, including Part D drugs into the bundled payments, but I think it is something that we haven't explored. The only example where we have done this is in end-stage renal disease, where the Congress mandated that drugs be included in the end-stage renal disease program, and for all intents and purposes, it seems to be working very well. So I think if we can build on the ESRD demonstration programs, I think we can actually start including Part D drugs into bundled payments.
Jerry, let me ask you. So, you know, Part D drugs are not just fee-for-service, but they're also paid for by Part D plans, not by Medicare directly. And Medicare is prohibited from negotiating the price of those drugs. What generally do you think about the idea of not just drugs being part of bundling, but Medicare being able to negotiate those prices?
So the first thing is the carve-out issue is a challenge, but I think, and I don't want to spend a lot of time going into it today, but I think it is a challenge that can be met. There are a number of different technical ways to do it in terms of carve-outs, of taking the money out and setting it aside or a variety of things. And CMS has a whole series of expenditure plans for that. On the larger issue, what you look at is Medicare Part D and the catastrophic part of Medicare Part D, which is growing about four to five times faster than overall drug spending. And that's predominantly, partially because we're getting a little bit sicker, but mostly, and then for more people are entering the catastrophic phase. But when the legislation was passed back in 2003, there wasn't very many drugs that cost over $7,000. And once the drug costs more than $7,000, it automatically becomes a catastrophic expenditure. And Medicare right now pays 80% of that cost, yet has no ability to negotiate at all. So if there's going to be negotiation in the Medicare program, I think it should start at least in where the drug costs more than $7,000, Medicare pays 80% of the cost, and therefore has a real skin in the game for those particular, the cost of those particular drugs.
Can I just...
Yeah, sure, please.
Going to jump in there. I mean, I think there's just a lot of discussion about Medicare negotiation that is based on a conception that there isn't negotiation happening now, which is, I think, you know, it's just wrong, right? Because the Part D plans, even though there is a catastrophic phase of the benefit where the government bears the risk through reinsurance, those Part D plans are still negotiating those prices. And I think it would be naive to assume that they don't do a pretty fierce job of negotiating prices. So I think the other problem is that we're not having a very honest conversation about the trade-off here, because there's a sense that you can have Medicare set the price for some of those higher cost medicines without any reduction in access. And I think the experience just shows that's not the case. That's not the way it works in VA. It's not the way it works overseas. That, of course, governments can and do set prices, but when they do, that generally reduces choice. And if you ask people, voters, what they want, of course, they'll say they want lower prices. Everyone wants lower prices for everything, right? But if you ask them, what's more important to you? Do you want the lowest possible cost for your medicines? Or do you want to have access to a wide array of new treatment options and have some choice there? People will generally always choose choice. So it's about achieving that cost-choice trade-off, and no one is talking about that. I mean, there's a perception that there's a free lunch here, and CBO and others have said that just isn't going to happen, and that to sort of hold out the promise of Medicare negotiation means you can have lower costs without any reduction in choice is a false promise.
Jenny, can you give some examples of that where, you know, in the VA or in other countries where there is either price setting or more aggressive negotiation of price where choice has suffered?
Well, sure. I mean, the VA is a special program, right, that serves a very special population. And the reality is a lot of people in the VA actually carry it supplemental coverage, so they don't even rely fully on it. But if you there was a study that was done recently that looked at the 25 newly approved medicines, for example, in VA, and about 12% of the medicines were covered in VA, and 81% were covered on average in Part D plans. All of the medicines were covered in at least one or more Part D plans, but on average, about 81% were covered. And, you know, VA just didn't offer the same level of coverage. And if you look at Europe, the same is true if you're looking at new cancer medicines. I think between 2007 and 13, the UK rejected or restricted access to more than half of all the new cancer treatments that they reviewed. And patients just wait longer to have access to new treatments. I mean, sometimes what happens is they wait for the evidence to accumulate in the U.S. from U.S. patients using the drugs and showing that they work, and then they'll approve them. But that's not, I think, the system that U.S. voters are looking for.
So we've had a number of, we've been talking about prices, and we've had a number of questions about sort of what goes into the price of a drug, what is the role of R&D expenditures and as a component of price. You know, one thing we're lacking in healthcare generally, but specifically with drugs, is transparency. I mean, we know a lot less about prices of drugs than we do about other products. It's an issue that's come up. I mean, Donald Trump has proposed more price transparency in healthcare generally. There have been bills in states to require drug companies, in some cases, to disclose what goes into the price of drugs. Jenny, let me start with you. I mean, what would be your concern about more transparency around prices and what goes into them?
So I think more transparency that is helpful to patients would always be a good thing, right? So we've been very supportive of efforts that would provide information that patients can use and that's actionable for them. So what are my benefits? What is covered? How much am I going to pay at the pharmacy? Information that actually helps patients make good cost-quality trade-offs, because that's how markets work, right? So information about prices that patients will face, we think would be really helpful. I think we also believe that more information for decision makers that helps them plan ahead for the impact of new medicines on their premium and how to think about coverage as they're designing benefit plans, you know, 18 months out, is also really useful for the earlier conversation about conversations that the health plans and manufacturers would have and sort of needing to make it easier to have good conversations about the value of the medicines that are coming to market. Where I think we would be concerned and have registered opposition is when you see transparency bills that where it's not really about information that people can use, but it's just sort of a try to shame and blame manufacturers for high prices in a very transparent way of like just building a case for price setting. And I think that we've seen that as not the right direction to go. And we think that it just adds cost to the system. One other thing I'd say is that sometimes you'll see transparency proposals that are looking for really granular information about the price that's negotiated between a health plan or a pharmacy benefit manager and a manufacturer. And we've been concerned about that sort of level of transparency because there's a lot of economic evidence that that will actually drive prices up, not down. And so the FTC and the Congressional Budget Office have both sort of opined on that level of transparency as being exactly the reverse of what is needed. So we've been opposed to that. But just, again, we're not opposed to the notion of transparency. I mean, it's about how it's done and making it meaningful to patients.
And Jerry, how about you? I mean, is there a role for more transparency in drug pricing specifically?
In drug pricing and in R&D. So let me just start briefly with R&D. Sort of the conventional number that we hear all the time is it costs about $2.6 billion to develop a new drug. And the problem with that number is that it's not transparent. We don't know which drugs it was based on. We don't know the methodology. And so, you know, we hear this number of $2.6 billion, but it's not a number that is, in fact, transparent. In terms of transparency of prices, generally, I was over in Europe not too long ago and a meeting with a whole series of health ministers, and they could not compare prices that they were paying for the drugs because of exclusionary provisions in their contracts. They wanted to know whether France was getting a better drug than Spain, and they couldn't talk about that, the way the system works. So they were very upset. Within the United States, you know, maybe everybody's like Wobegon and everybody's getting a better deal than everybody else, but there's a lot of uncertainty about how much chargeback, how much rebate, how much discount is one person getting versus another. So there's just so much uncertainty. And if you look within the federal government alone, what you see is the prices that one part of the federal government is going to pay is twice as much as another part of the federal government. They're insuring, they're buying the same drug, they're insuring people in the federal government, yet some places are paying twice as much as other places. I mean, we've got to have much more transparency. A drug is something that everybody needs. It's something that should have a single price to it. I mean, for hospitals, you get a little bit of a discount if you're in one place. A doctor gives you somewhat of a discount. For drugs, it's 2-to-1, 3-to-1 differences. That's much higher, and we need a lot greater price transparency. Sorry.
Dana, how about you?
First of all, I've been studying this market for 20 years, and I still can't figure out what the price is. So I would love to get some transparency. That being said, there are actually two aspects of the transparency movement that your question alluded to and that Jenny talked about. And I think one is misguided, one's not. So, for example, we talk about R&D spending. Well, think about Apple, okay? When we see the price they have for their iPhone, no one asks how much did it cost to manufacture. No one says how much R&D did you put into it. The question of value derives from how useful it is in people's lives, how productive it is, how enjoyable it is. And with drugs, value derives from their contribution to health. I don't care how much the R&D cost. If it's really valuable, we want it and people should pay for it. And if it's not valuable, we shouldn't be paying so much for it. And so this move to figure out the cost, the value of something based on the cost of its inputs, you know, that actually goes back to Karl Marx, labor theory of value. It's really not how we think about value. And so if we want to move toward the system where price reflects value, we should have transparency on what the user prices are, but we don't really need transparency into the cost of developing it. I mean, even in oil, for example, where we know exploration is expensive, we don't say how much did it cost to build this rig. We have a market that decides what the price is. So I think in transparency, part of this is moving in the wrong direction because it's not talking about value. And part of it is when we talk about looking into prices. I will say, though, that opacity has some benefits. Not everyone benefits. So when Medicaid, I mentioned earlier Medicaid, the federal government passed a law that Medicaid got the best price. There were some people, some insurers out there who had some very good deals and prior to that. And what happened is the manufacturers said, we can't continue those deals because Medicaid gets the best price. So there are some payers, and these are probably the big payers, who have tens of millions of enrollees who are getting very low prices and don't want anyone to know. And the net effect of transparency may be that it raises prices for some people. That being said, I'm all in favor of figuring out what the price is.
But Dana, is there something different about drugs than an iPhone? Because maybe health is more fundamental than the newest phone, maybe because the government plays such a role in regulating drugs and paying for drugs through public payers. We don't have congressional hearings about the cost of an iPhone. Is there some greater need for transparency in what goes into R&D and the cost of producing and developing a drug that's different from a
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, I agree with you. The reason why we have hearings is because someone else is paying for other people's drugs, actually. I think it's because in the iPhone case, we pay for our own iPhones. But in the case of Medicaid, it's taxpayers paying for drugs for people that we care about, which are typically indigent. It's part of it is someone else is paying for it, and we worry we want them to have access for sure. But, you know, we also have this in food. I mean, food is a basic staple. Education gets priced that way to some extent, although we provide subsidies. And I think education is a good analogy because what we do is we try to subsidize the high cost of tuition. And I think part of the problem here is not people are upset about price. They're really upset about insurance coverage. So the price of an ICU stay is $500,000. What's going into that? What's the R&D? Why are the surgical instruments so expensive? We're not having hearings about that. And I think it's because ICU stay is covered quite generously. In fact, if someone goes into the ICU, there's a very high chance they're going to die. So if I look at the mortality, I say, well, are we wasting all this money? You know, but yet no one is having hearings about that. And I think it's because we don't, and Jerry alluded to it, a lot of these are not covered quite generously. And what I'll say is the trend in insurance has been to cover generic drugs fully, and to cover preferred brands pretty well. And then, but if you're a patient, and I call this double jeopardy, let's say you're a patient diagnosed with a condition and the generic drug doesn't work and then maybe the preferred brand doesn't work, you're now in a world where you might be paying 50% cost sharing on drugs that cost tens of thousands of dollars. As far as I'm concerned, that's a problem of insurance. The whole point of it, those people, not only have they found out their disease is relatively pernicious because the usual treatments don't work, but now they're being asked to shoulder a higher financial burden to get treatment. And that's the part. I actually think, you know, the whole point of insurance is to cover the catastrophic part. You know, we don't buy auto insurance for our oil changes. We buy it for our accidents. And so I think the problem here is not on the price. It's on the insurance side.
And just to answer your question, Larry, about Apple versus the pharmaceutical industry, I've never heard Apple justify the price of their phone because of the R&D cost that they put into it. But that's what you hear from the pharmaceutical industry. We need all these profits for the R&D. So in that
I agree with you. I don't know why they, I don't think that's a reasonable argument.
But it's an argument that you hear all the time.
Yeah.
And so if you're going to justify your high prices on the basis of R&D costs, I think you have to be much more transparent about what are your true R&D costs. So if Gilead buys a particular company, Pharmacet, for $11 billion, is that R&D or is that a purchase price, but it's not really R&D? I mean, they got the product.
But Jerry, I don't understand why you care. I mean, if someone buys R&D, I don't know that it would have come to market. I mean, as a consumer, what I care about is drugs that are valuable enter the marketplace and continue to do so. And I think when we ask for price, I don't think it's fair to say to an industry, because you're making an argument that doesn't make sense, well, therefore, we're going to regulate and you need to open up all the books. I mean, we should have good public policy, and good public policy here is price transparency on what the prices are, not on what goes into the cost of production.
Except that the justification is often the huge R&D investment that they have to make. So you can't make that argument and then not be transparent about the R&D investment that you have to make.
Well, I mean, I think you can. I don't think that for an individual product that you're going to find too many companies suggesting that I put this much into the R&D and therefore I have to recoup it. I think the general point, though, is that drug development is an incredibly risky proposition, and investors do need to make a determination about where they want to invest. And if what we're talking about is maintaining incentives for people to make these risky choices with a long-term payout long-term in the future. You have companies, you know, that are unprofitable for 30 years before they ever turn a profit. You need to hold out the potential for them to reap a reward. So that, I think, is the fundamental point that people are making. But I think, you know...
Go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, I just want to come back to this notion, too, that I think underlies a lot of the proposals that we're seeing around drug costs, which is that that drugs are the most important driver of healthcare cost growth in the country. And you see a lot of people fanning the flames of that. And while we have had several years of higher than average healthcare, of drug spending growth, the reality is over the last decade, it was not true that drugs are the primary driver of healthcare spending. And looking into the next decade, it's also not true. And we are going to spend five times more on increased spending for hospital physician and other healthcare services than we are for increased spending on medicines. And I think that there's no question we're getting huge value and payoff from what we have invested in medicines, and that we're making enormous progress in cancer and in a number of critical diseases, and we're about to make much more. And so I think it's really important to put the cost into some kind of context, because absent that context, policymakers will rush to make sweeping policy decisions to ramp down that spending on prescription medicines and cut off investment in important new medicines for Alzheimer's and other conditions.
Though it is true that in recent years, drug spending has increased faster than other parts of the health system, right?
That's right, but if you look at the last 10 years, I think that's only true for, I've done the math. I think it's like 3 out of the last 10 years. So nobody was complaining when drug spending was lower.
Well, we're coming to the close of the hour, though I'm pretty sure we could do this for another hour, but we can't. So I want to ask all of you, this is a final question. Putting aside politics, what would be your priority as a new administration takes office, as there's potentially new leadership in Congress? What are the one or two things, quickly you would tell a new president or a new Congress, if asked, should get done to address drug costs? Jenny, let me start with you.
Sure. I think there are 3 things. The first is that in Medicare, and we need to remove this double jeopardy, that people who are very sick and end up in the catastrophic part of their coverage, we should start closing that. There's almost unlimited liability there. And the second is that we need to ensure timely access to generics. As I said, you want some period where you reward the innovators, but I think we play some tricks in the generic market to when that period is up so people don't get timely access. And so making sure that generics enter the market at the right time is a very important part. And then the third thing is that, as I've said, just like we regulate the electricity market, I think there's room for regulation of the generic market to ensure a safe and reliable supply and also a fair rate of return.
Jenny, from pharma's perspective, what would be the one or two things you would want to see to address drug costs in a new administration?
So I think first would be to focus on modernizing the FDA and making sure that the science, the regs are really keeping up with the science, both with the FDA and also in HHS, so that the prescription drug market can evolve like the rest of the market is, away from fee-for-service and more toward pay-for-value. I think there are a number of things that could be done there that would really move the ball forward. And some of the work isn't very sexy. It's things like investing in development of better quality measures and outcome measures that could be used to hold everyone accountable. And I think that would also be a step in the right direction. So modernized regulations, I think, would be the code word for me.
And Jerry, you get the final word here. If asked by a new president, what are your one or two top priorities in addressing drug costs?
So the first one I would do was agree with Jenny in terms of value-based purchasing. Drugs are right now paid on fee-for-service basis. We need to start putting them into bundles. We can do that. It's going to take a while, but we need to do it. And we then put the doctor as the one who decides which drug you need and which you don't. In terms of very expensive drugs, especially for the Medicare program, I think Medicare really does need to negotiate the prices for drugs that cost more than $7,000. They can't have no skin in the game and have to pay 80% of the cost. So they have to do something. And the third thing is much greater competition for generic drugs. We've got 17% of the generic drugs with no competitors. They're the ones that are the real problems, and we need to make sure that there are no more mergers, consolidations, acquisitions in the generic space, and we get the generic drugs out there and competing as fast as we can.
Well, great. We'll need to stop it there. Thanks to all of our great panelists, and thanks to everyone for listening. As I mentioned, you'll find a recording of the discussion and more information on drug spending at kfs.org/healthcosts. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the webinar for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your line.